people who are working for the climate or other social justice issues right here at home. So as we develop...
Elsa Levasseur, and I'm a sustaining member, and I give monthly on the internet. It's so easy to listen to WGXC Accra.
Hi, this is Michael Cole, the Columbia County Director of Community Services. The abuse of opiates has reached epidemic proportions in our country, our states, and in our county. Our local youth and their families have been impacted by the current opiate epidemic. Opiate abuse does not discriminate. However, there is hope. Treatment works and recovery is possible. Education is the key to dispelling myths that perpetuate the stigma associated with addiction. Information on how to get involved in the solution is available at 518-828-9446 or ColumbiaCountyMHC.com. Thank you.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Gemini Construction, a full-service contracting firm specializing in complete electrical construction services. Gemini Construction, serving Greene and surrounding counties for over 40 years. For more information, contact 518-622-9829.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Audrey Berman of Germantown, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
And this is the Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler, and we're broadcasting from Hudson, Columbia County, New York. This is WGXC 90.7 FM, Acra, Catskill, Hudson, listener-supported radio for your open ears. And this is my October podcast for the month, 2019. And we have in the studio today, Sandy McKnight.
Hi, Chad.
Sandy, welcome. He's a Renaissance artist, and is this the first book that you've written?
I wrote two other books, but they were very short. I call them bookettes, and they were comedy books. So this is more of a serious tome.
And this the book is called Kids 69. Your memoir of the year.
Well, thank you. It has been nominated for memoir of the year, but yes, of course, 1969 is the year you're referring to. My experiences in 1969, which who cares? But I think it really represents a very relatable series of events. It's more about a coming of age thing, and what intrigued me about writing about that particular era is that the country was coming of age in many ways, as was I. So the juxtaposition, if you will, or even if you won't, was intriguing for me to write about.
And you're from Brooklyn, New York?
I am, yes. Don't hold that against me, please.
But no, it's too late now.
Yeah.
Born and bred.
We're in Brooklyn North, right? So that's cool.
What were some of the best memories of growing up in Brooklyn?
Well, of course, you know, there's the sort of east side, west side, all around the town kind of memories, like playing ball in the street and, you know, eating Mr. Softy and stuff like that. But I think what really made my Brooklyn experience unique, or not unique, but special, was the kind of characters you meet in a place like that. And in those days, in my neighborhood, which was in Bensonhurst, it was mainly an Italian neighborhood, but it was probably about 40% Jewish. So we had that mix. And while that was not particularly diverse, it was interesting how both cultures kind of mingled and actually figured out how to kind of get along and be in many ways similar to each other, even though with all the differences of the cultural background. So my neighborhood in Bath Beach, which was part of Bensonhurst, was pretty much Italian. And, you know, it was a mafia neighborhood, but you didn't really see it, except occasionally when a car would explode or something, you know. but, you know, you just knew that, like, you could leave your doors open and nobody was, you know, you were safe.
And everybody knew everybody?
I wouldn't go that far because it's, you know, big town, but...
I mean, was the street you lived on, what were the buildings made up of?
It was like, you know, a lot of single family and like two family houses, mostly built probably in the 20s. And so it had that sort of, you know, it wasn't like massive buildings like in Manhattan. So it was, you know, you knew people on the block, of course, and some people just to say hello, and others, you know, you would, like, I'd play ball on Bay 13th Street, which was the name of the street I was living on. And, you know, there's actually a story in the book about a little touch football game that got out of hand in 1969. I was... 15 when the year started, turned 16 on July 1st. And so I, you know, I was still a kid, hence the title of the book.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I was doing things like, you know, playing touch football on the street at the same time that I was also like going to Chicago and demonstrating against the war and, you know.
So you were pretty independent, sounds like.
Yeah, I had a weird family situation. My parents were very kind of, I wouldn't say liberal, they were laissez-faire, which, you know, looking back, it's kind of shocking. But at the time, it was cool because I got to do what I wanted. And they were going through their own transitional stuff. Which eventually led them to being divorced in, you know, 75 or something. But at that point, they were experimenting with stuff. Smoking pot, you know, having... Well, they had this setup where kids, I call them kids, but they were older than me. They were like college age, maybe. would come over the house and... at random times and hang out. The reason for that was my dad was running a church youth group and the church stopped having that group. And my father kind of picked up the ball and ran with it. And as these kids started to come over, it became sort of a party scene. it wasn't like wild. People were respectful, but stuff was going on, you know, and I was a few years younger than the people who came over. So I didn't really relate to them, and they were very preppy kind, and I wasn't. But it was kind of a good cover for me because I could go out and do stuff and nobody really paid much attention to what I was doing. When I went to Chicago in 68, I announced that I was going to Chicago. And my parents said, "Do you have a place to stay? And will you call us every day?"
That's great, though.
And so I went. And then they watched on TV as I got tear gassed.
Did you go by bus?
I did. I went with a group called the Fifth Avenue Peace Parade Committee. And they had been sponsoring anti-war demonstrations in Manhattan. And they sold the tickets for the bus. I think it was like maybe $18 round trip or something like that.
Yeah.
And then we stayed at some college, you know, dormitory type place in Chicago. And other than that, they didn't really do much except hand us a sheet that said, you know, this is where stuff is. Good luck, you know. And one of the things I did on my second day there was to buy a army surplus gas mask, which turned out to be a good idea.
And it worked?
And it worked.
Huh?
And I also managed to avoid getting arrested. And a guy standing next to me got arrested, but I, for some reason, wasn't grabbed in the process. And so that was my first kind of, you know, political venture. And so I got very radicalized from that experience.
Would you say that your fellow students that you were, when you were going to school, did they feel the same way?
I think there was a anti-war feeling was strong amongst my peers. I went to a school called Brooklyn Tech, which was a special school. You had to take a test to get in. It was one of three New York City schools that were, you know, arts and sciences, and Stuyvesant, I think, was the other one. And so it was like all boys. And it was, you know, there was a good number of people who were against the war, but I don't know if it was necessarily politically astute. But what I did in 69, which got me kicked out of Brooklyn Tech, was I ran a mock campaign for student president. And I think I would have gotten away with that if I hadn't called my party the Pot Party. That was my mistake. 'Cause then they called in the police, and it was like, oh, are you having pot parties at your house? They made my mother come in, you know. Mrs. McKnight, is this your son is selling pot, obviously. Is he? Yeah. So that was the end of that. And then they kicked me out. And then, so that was that. That's why that summer became interesting, because after I didn't have to go to school anymore, I was able to get a job, and I was able to afford an apartment in the East Village. So at 15, I lived on East 6th Street between 1st and 2nd Avenue, now known or recently known as the Indian restaurant hub of America. But at the time was not that. It was just a street.
Yeah.
And you didn't go past 1st Avenue if you knew what was good for you in those days. But it was right down the street from the Fillmore. And Fillmore East, of course,
yes.
you're more familiar with the
Fillmore West.
The Fillmore West or the Avalon Ballroom, right?
What? Yeah.
But yeah, so that was right in the middle of everything. And in 69, it was really, that was kind of New York summer. 67, they call the Summer of Love, but that was really a West Coast thing. West Coast was always a little ahead with the whole hippie thing.
Yeah.
New York kind of caught up by 69, and so that summer was a great summer to be in New York. And, of course, there was the moonwalk that summer. The Mets were amazing people.
And you're still a Mets fan.
I'm still a Mets fan. Oh, yeah. They fired Callaway today. That's interesting. But anyway, yeah, so it was a great summer from a lot of different standpoints. And I got to hang out with some people.
Okay.
I don't use any words that would be taboo. Well, you know, drugs and sex, I mean, you know, and rock and roll, of course. So I do touch on all those subjects, but I do it in a very tasteful way, Chad.
Yeah, good.
I don't pander to my audience.
But you do tell a yarn.
I tell a yarn or two. Actually, it's very, it's not a big book. It's 130 pages or something. And it's anecdotal for the most part, but there is a kind of an arc to the whole story, which is based on my optimism going into the year, especially after 68, which was a horrible year, where we lost a lot of people who were important, and we also got Nixon. So 69 was like, okay, let's turn it around. And it felt like we did. It felt like we were actually, you know, making some progress. And then kind of fell apart in the fall and winter after Woodstock. There was definitely a dip after Woodstock. It felt like, okay, now what? You know, what do we do for an encore?
Yeah.
And there wasn't one. In fact, Altamont was the encore that failed, you know.
And also, in a way, a disaster.
Yes. And it between that and the Manson killings, it really damaged the whole hippie brand, you know. To talk about it in 2019 terminology, the branding was damaged by that series of events.
Well, were you also interested in the folk music?
Music was not so genre specific in those days, and so we would be equally interested in the Vanilla Fudge, who I saw at Central Park in 1968, and, you know, Tim Hardin or Phil Oakes or, you know, folkies. So, yeah, it wasn't like a thing like, oh, I'm into, you know, metal, or I'm into, you know, it's just like music was music.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons Woodstock was so cool, was because you had that mix of people. You had The Who, and then you had, you know, Santana, and all kinds of stuff that was different from each other. It wasn't all like just one rock scene. And of course, Friday, the first day of Woodstock, was the folky day. Mm. And so you had your Joan Baez's, and you had your Tim Hardens and those people. And Richie Havens, of course, who was great. And, I had seen all of them before that at the Fillmore. In fact, one of the first shows I saw at the Fillmore was Richie Havens opening. No, I'm sorry. It was Richie Havens was the headliner. Oh. The Trogs opened for Richie Havens, which I think indicates the kind of, you know, eclectic vibe of the scene at the time. And there were a lot of shows like that, you know, The Doors opening for Simon and Garfunkel, you know, stuff like that. Just nobody questioned that or said, that's not a good mix, you know. It was just like, oh, here's one really cool music act and here's another one, you know, and that was it.
Were you one of the people who actually bought a ticket to Woodstock?
No, I have, I actually have a ticket, but my parents bought the ticket because they went.
Oh.
They went separately, and they went on Friday and left after Friday because it was maybe too intense for them, or I don't know. They were in their late 30s, and I was 16 at that point. And so when my dad passed recently, he left me some of his Woodstock memorabilia.
Wow.
So I have the original program, which is kind of rare.
Yeah.
And I have a set of tickets. But I knew that there wasn't going to be a need for tickets based on my inside hip knowledge of the scene, man.
Did you go with others or were you solo?
Solo. It was kind of a spontaneous thing. I was working at a job in Brooklyn, actually. I did the reverse commute, you know, from Manhattan to Brooklyn. And I quit the job so I could go to Woodstock. At that point, I had paid my rent for the summer and I was good.
Oh.
So I when I went, it was Wednesday, which was early, and I packed a pillowcase. And in the pillowcase, I put like maybe 3 shirts and a bottle of cheap cologne. That was my packing. And I went over to the Port Authority and I got on a bus for Monticello, which I knew was somewhere in the vicinity of where Woodstock was going to be, figuring that when I got off the bus, there'd be lots of hippies and I would just say, hey, man, take me to Woodstock. Yeah. And that's pretty much how it happened. I got off the bus, had a little trouble finding someone who knew what was going on, but I did. And they drove me to the site and so I was there like 2 days early, which was interesting because I got to know all the back roads and how to get in and out, and that came in handy later on when I wanted to explore other places. And so, like, for instance, on Saturday for lunch, I went to Jeffersonville, which is a nearby town. I hitched there. I went to the Woolworths and got lunch and then hitched back. And, you know, the guy who picked me up going back, I got him into the site, which he wouldn't have been able to do because I knew the back roads. So it was good getting there early.
You were a whippersnapper, weren't you?
I was a snapper. speaking of which, I actually have a story about snappers in the book as well. But that's that's a whole other thing. I was just like, nothing fazed me, really. Mm. It's that wonderful feeling when you're young, or at least used to be. I don't know how young people are today because I avoid them. But or they avoid me. I'm not sure what is actually happening. But it's that naivete that you bring into things that, oh, I can do that. Yeah, I'll figure it out. And that's how I was. And I made a lot of dumb mistakes.
But you're here to tell the tale.
I am here. For next few minutes anyway. And I guess survived. And I learned some things. And I think what's interesting about the book, if I may pat myself on the back a little, is that I could actually reach my back at this age is interesting. But that's another story. The thing I think is interesting about the book is that it's written from the standpoint of that guy, not me 50 years later saying, oh, and then listen to this, I did this jerky thing and that was really dumb. And because that would have been really boring, I think, you know, to be like judging the 15-year-old me 50 years later.
So you're staying with him being a teenager and trying to tell it from a teenager's
point of view. I wanted like a as it happened kind of story. I did, you know, it feels to me when I read it like it's the 17-year-old me talking about what happened, you know. So there's no judgmental stuff. My first draft had some of that judgmental stuff, and I just thought, wow, that's really boring. I mean, you know, anybody could be hard on themselves 50 years after they were a jerky kid. I mean, that's so easy, you know. But to be just sort of putting yourself back in that place you were in, where everything was new and everything was fun and everything was interesting and danger, you know, didn't mean anything. That's kind of a good place to revisit, I think, for people. And
did 1969 change you as a person, or was it you're just in transition to being Sandy?
I think it did. In the book, I talk a little bit about how I went from being sort of a political animal a little bit in the early part of 69 and being involved with all that stuff that was going on, the anti-war stuff and everything. And then kind of transitioning after Woodstock to another, a different mindset where it was about changing ourselves, not changing society. Mm. And I think that's what led us to that wonderful me decade of the 70s. I'm being facetious there. but it had to go that way because we weren't going to change society or politics or anything the way we were trying to do it. But it made people more aware of alternate ideas, alternate lifestyles, alternate, you know, I mentioned that all of a sudden people cared about things like yoga and, you know, like things that they existed before that. And some people were into it, but you know, not at the level that it is now and the level that it became in the 70s, where people were interested in exotic philosophies. And, you know, some people went down the path of Scientology and all that kind of stuff and cultism.
Yeah.
And others, you know, got into health food. And, you know, it's just like all that stuff came out of the 60s, even though we weren't doing it yet in the 60s, really. You know, it was like kind of like the 70s were about taking the ideas of the 60s and trying to make them into a pragmatic lifestyle thing.
Well, it also led us into the environmental revolt, and Earth Day being in 1971, mm-hmm. and that's sort of a carryover.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing I often say, and try not to make this too rote because it's something I do a lot of these interviews, is that the coming of age element of the book, which was my coming of age, was also paralleling the country's coming of age in that we started to recognize that we weren't all the same. There were gay people, and Stonewall happened that summer. There are women who are not wanting to be housekeepers and housewives. And, you know, that was all a revelation at that time. And you know, all of the liberation movements came out of that era. And, of course, not everyone thinks that's a good thing. But most of the people who don't are going to be dead very soon.
When did you decide to become a musician?
Thursday.
This week? Or?
Yeah, last week I got into it. No, it was a summer of 68. I was really into music after the Beatles. And I always kind of thought of myself as being in a band, but I didn't play any instruments. So I got together with some people at Brooklyn Tech who played, and they said, well, what you should do is learn the bass because we're a guitarist and a drummer and we need a bass player. So I actually bought a bass on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. There was a little factory there that made cheap basses. Hmm. And I bought one for like $70 or something.
That was a lot of money.
Well, for me, but you know, in the world of musical instruments, it wasn't that much. And it was, you know, and I learned how to play it one string at a time.
Self-taught?
Self-taught. What I did was the guitar player would play a lot of bar chords. So he was all the way up and down the neck with the bar chords, and I would follow on the E string of the bass. So that's how I learned. Then I figured out, oh, wait, I can play this note on the A string instead of the E string, and I won't have to move my hand so far up the neck. And then gradually, I figured it out.
It's pretty unusual, but and then you went to the guitar, or did you stick with the bass for a while?
Somebody showed me how to open tune a guitar, and that was the moment for me to switch over. Because, I mean, I still play bass, and I'm that's my main instrument.
Oh, okay.
But guitar became a good songwriting tool. and enabled me to delve more into the writing end. And I still, you know, don't play guitar that well, but I was able to create different kinds of chords with this open tuning. So I developed a style which sounds different than regular guitar players.
Was there any other profession that you considered going into?
Phlebotomy was one. I wasn't interested, but I liked the way it sounded.
What is that, phlebotomy?
Phlebotomy is the study of blood. Like a phlebotomist is a blood guy.
Hmm.
And, of course, I'm making this up.
Yeah, I know you too well, Sandy.
Yes. Yeah, I briefly got into lion taming, but it wasn't much of a future in that.
You don't like lying too much, but you'll tell a yarn or two.
Yes. You can't hide your lion eyes. But, no, I was never, I don't know. I always thought of myself as a musician, as a songwriter. I thought I could write, but I couldn't. And that's why doing this book was kind of interesting, because 20, 30 years later, I learned that I could write, and I started writing sketch comedy, which is a different kind of writing than novels or whatever. And I don't think I can write a novel, but I could write well enough to write an interesting memoir. So I was brave enough to say, okay, I'm going to do this. And it was 50 years anniversary of 1969, so I thought this is the time to do it before I get too old and forget all these things, you know.
Had you been making notes along the way, or are you just...
No. I told a lot of stories at parties and things, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, not parties, but, yeah, talking to people. And so these stories I remember, and, the events were so kind of monumental, or at least memorable, that it wasn't hard to kind of remember. I had to dig a little bit to remember some names and places and stuff. And, of course, I had to change a few names.
To protect the innocent?
Yes, exactly. Or the guilty. And I, you know, so the writing process was really interesting, because I already had all the stories. I just had to put them down on paper and find a way to do it. First challenge was to find a voice, because, as I said before, I didn't want to be the old guy telling the stories of when I was young. So I found that voice, and then I actually went to Florida.
Hmm.
I tried to think of what would be the most boring place I could that would not distract me from writing. So I went to Tampa, Florida. And I checked into a motel, a Marriott or whatever, and I sat there for 3 days and I started writing. And by doing that, I got about half the book finished in the room. And then I decided to take a train back instead of a plane, which would give me another day to write.
Yeah.
So I wrote a couple of chapters on the train, so that by the time I got back, I was, you know, 2/3 through the book. And then the rest came eventually. But, yeah, you need to kind of, well, I need to kind of discipline myself in a way that I'd never been before. Writing songs comes naturally to me, but writing stories is a different thing. Even my other books that I wrote, the bookettes, were not really stories. They were just kind of wacky comedy things.
Well, you know, I'm just looking at chapter one, and you really do get to the beginning. I was born in Brooklyn in 1953.
Yeah.
So we got to start somewhere, and you start at the beginning.
I wrote the first chapter after I wrote the rest of the book, because my editor, Lieve Cummins, you know Lieve?
Oh, yeah.
She actually said
Your
to
muse.
Me, yes. She said to me, you know, you got to tell a little backstory here, because... who are you? You know? And I always remembered Nixon's book started with, I was born in the house of my father built, or something like that. Yeah. And I always thought that was cool. It's one of the few cool things Nixon did. But yeah, so I thought, you know, okay, I'll give a brief history of my first 15 years. And I think that worked well for the book, because now you get a sense of where I'm coming from, what kind of family I was in. But that wasn't the story I wanted to tell. That wasn't really, you know, I didn't want to get too deep into any of those things. So I kind of, you know, just gave a quick synopsis of my life up to that point, so that by the time you get to chapter two, I'm now 15 and living my year of craziness.
Were you? Would you call yourself a delinquent?
I called myself a truant because I was actually arrested for truancy at one point, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
In fact, I started a band called The Truants in the 70s.
Makes sense.
Because I was a truant. I don't think I was a delinquent in the sense that I was like stealing hubcaps or anything. But hubcaps for those of you out there. but yeah, I don't think I was motivated by crime.
Well, that's good.
Unlike today, where I already stolen 3 microphones from your studio.
Yeah, at least we got the last few working. out of curiosity, because you know we grew up on different coasts,
right,
and totally different lives in the sense I was just too wimpy and naive. You know, maybe we were both naive, but I was wimpy and you weren't.
Well.
And
false bravado, I call it.
Were you ever, like I was, drafted?
I was given a number in the draft, in the lottery.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
And it was a very low number.
Me too.
And luckily, the war kind of fizzled out by the time I was ready to be drafted.
Oh.
I did go to my physical examination, which I somehow passed. I actually was only 2 pounds over the weight that I would have gotten let off, but I was 127. I was 6 feet tall, 127 pounds. It's pretty scary.
Yeah. No shadow from you.
No, no. I was like a stick figure. But I didn't know that there was a weight thing. I would have tried to lose the other 2 pounds if I knew that.
And you could have.
I could have, yeah. Well, you know, when you're kind of on your own, you don't eat much. That's a thing, you know. I used to buy like a loaf of bread and just eat that because it would fill you up.
Yeah.
You know.
And you make it last a week.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and if you get lucky enough to buy like peanut butter, then you're set. You know?
So after 1969.
Yes.
As you know, I don't want to give away the ending of the book, but you know, obviously 69 does come to an end.
There's a big explosion at the end, and my car goes off a cliff. It's pretty exciting. No, that's not true. That's the movie version that will be out next year. I don't really go too deep into what happened after 1969 because that's the next book. Kid 70 coming.
You've got
out
at least
soon.
Then, therefore, 49 more books at least.
It's a very long series. Now, the other years I wouldn't be able to remember at all. It's 1969 is the year I remember. But
and you're lucky to remember.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't a big druggie. That was what kind of, I guess, maybe saved my brain. But 70, what I remember about after 69 was that I started to try to be a little more practical and not get arrested. Because I got arrested twice in 69, once for truancy and once for, well, actually 68. I demonstrated at election night in Times Square, and they arrested me. You know, juvenile. That's not on it's not on my permanent record. I've made many records, but not that.
No.
But yeah, that was 70, it just felt different, you know? I mean, the number, I mean, I talk about how the number 69 was significant as a sort of Beavis and Butthead joke, you know? But it felt like that's got to be a cool year, you know, 69, man, you know, as if we even really knew what that meant. But
well, it already has a curiosity aspect to it where if you wrote about 1973, you'd already lose a couple people.
The 70s were not like memorable in terms of I mean, there were certainly events, and there's these documentaries on CNN about the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, and you forget that, wow, that happened, wow, that. But I think maybe what made the 70s seem more boring was that the 60s were so amazing that it was almost impossible to top it. I mean, what do you do to top the Beatles, you know? I mean, there was no way to really, and people didn't want to. They wanted things to calm down, basically, in the 70s. And that's why it became more self-reflective, and, you know, people were going into analysis, and it was just a different decade, and it was what it had to be.
Do you have, in the book, any best buds that you talk about?
I did. It's not the focus of the book because when I was in school, there was one group of people that I knew, my two running mates in my election campaign from Brooklyn Tech, who I roped into doing it. But they didn't get kicked out. I did. But yeah, there wasn't really a individual that was like my sidekick, and which was good because I got to make my own decisions and go off and do things on my own. And there's a story in there about one day I decided, you know, I've never been to Philadelphia, and so I got on a train, and this is, you know, just a summer day, and I went into Philadelphia. I got off the train and I got up to street level, and there was a hippie girl crossing the street, and I, you know, we said hi, and she was going to a B-in.
Cool.
And so she said, hey, you want to come to the B-in? Sure. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing that you can do when you're on your own. You know, you don't have to worry about like finding another girl for your friend. And
well, you also had the advantage from East Coast is having buses and trains available to you.
Yeah, the transit system was very handy. And of course, when I was younger, I was intrigued with the subway system. I used to ride around. Instead of going to school, I would take the trains all day. And there's a couple of stories about my truancy days. I started to not go to school a lot in junior high school. And I never really liked school. I was eventually offered a free ride at Bard College because my parents worked there.
Oh.
But even that didn't grab me. I'm just not a school guy.
And maybe not an authority. You don't like authority, maybe.
Well, it's a combination of that and the fact that I didn't realize that I had anxiety issues. And I talk about that in the book, my first anxiety attacks, and how I was told by the school nurse to calm down. That was the advice that you got in those days, because nobody knew what anxiety was, and yeah, it wasn't a thing. And I think she offered me an aspirin, possibly. That was always a good solution to every problem. So, yeah, I mean, there's insights in the book that are not observations. They're just, it's like when you see an old movie and you go, gee, society was kind of weird in those days. People didn't care about this that we now think a lot about, you know. There's always that line in Vertigo. Jimmy Stewart says to Kim Novak, why don't you do this with your hair? It couldn't possibly matter to you. You know, like, well, of course you're going to do what I want because I'm the boyfriend. Stuff like that, you know, that it's like they're not making a point. In fact, they're just, you know, it was the way things were. And so when you look back, that's kind of more interesting than hearing me or some historian say, yes, the movie Vertigo was indicative of, yeah. I mean, you can make that observation, but in fact, I just did. But it's not that interesting as opposed to you making it yourself by seeing it. So that's what I tried to do with the book. I didn't judge my behavior. I just told what happened. And there are two abortions in the book. Some have said the book itself is an abortion, but that's another issue. But there's two abortions, and, you know, abortion wasn't legal in 1969. Mm. So from that standpoint, and how I handled those two incidents is indicative of the times and why things had to change. And that's kind of the point overall, is that when you look at those times, we were trying to change things, but we didn't yet have the tools or the knowledge of how to change things in a way that would be equitable to everyone. And that's why I say the society was coming of age. We were recognizing that these people existed, these women and these black people and these other people. But now, okay, how do we make it fair for them? How do we change things so that they're not feeling angry with us white guys, you know?
But it sounds like you've had very supportive parents. did that, the 68, 69, it sounds like they were willing to let Sandy be Sandy.
My father
make
was,
sure you're safe.
My father was kind of the supportive one in the sense that he thought so much of me that he didn't think I could do anything wrong. Now, whether or not that's a good parenting technique is questionable. But, I mean, that was the way it was. I didn't know anything other than that. My mother was a little more worried about it, but she was also even more passive than he was in the parenting department. So she just kind of sat back. And I think her strategy was always like, well, I won't commit to anything. And then if something happens, I could say, see, I told you. So, yeah. So that's the situation at home was very, as I said earlier, like a laissez-faire kind of thing, which was great for me as a 15-year-old because I thought, oh, great, I can do whatever I want. But not necessarily as good for me as when I got older and felt unstable or you know.
Did you think you needed more discipline or you would have maybe liked more discipline?
Guidance,
yeah.
You know, like how to handle the world. Because when I got out into the real world, I mean, that summer I was living in an apartment, but I wasn't dealing with, you know, I didn't have a phone or cable.
Were you living alone?
I was alone.
That's pretty unusual.
Yeah, it was a fifth floor walk-up on East 6th Street, and it was $75 a month.
See, that'll keep you skinny walking up and down.
Yes. Oh, I was in great shape. I was 127 pounds. But, yeah, I think in a lot of ways I benefited from the freedom. But in a lot of ways, maybe added to my future insecurity as an adult. What's the right answer? Does anyone really know the right way to raise a child?
No, and look at you now. You're a very well-adjusted older child.
Well, that's your impression. Ask others.
And they may have differing opinions.
Yes, some of your listeners may be familiar with my... instability, but
in that 68, 69, 70, when you were getting involved in music and
yes.
And a band, who were your influences, and did you as a band want to emulate or move into the path of previous bands, musicians?
I was a big Who fan. I had seen them play live several times before Woodstock, and of course they played at Woodstock, and then I saw them at the Forest Hills Tennis Stadium in 1971, maybe, when Who's Next came out. So that was like, yeah, the Who were spectacular in lots of ways. I like the energy of it and the power pop sound. And I was certainly a Beatles guy, and yeah, all that stuff influenced me. But also, as you remember from the 70s, although Chad, you're only about 45, maybe.
Almost getting there.
The 70s was all about experimentation. So there was I was in a jazz rock fusion band. I was in a boogie rock band called the Spitfire Boys.
I like that name. Yeah.
Simultaneously, I was in both of those bands.
Oh.
I played in a disco band in 1975, 76, pre-Saturday Night Fever in Brooklyn. It was all about playing different kinds of stuff, you know. So when I became sort of an artist / songwriter, I started to find a musical identity, which has served me somewhat well. And interestingly enough, for the last 15 years or so, a lot of my back catalog gets a lot of action because I recorded all this stuff in the late 70s through the 80s. And now there's like movies and TV shows about those eras.
Oh, sure.
And they want authentic music from that time that doesn't cost them an arm and a leg to use. And so I have all these great recordings of, Europop kind of stuff that I was doing in the early 80s. And yeah, so that was kind of a fun thing for my career that, the retro thing started to happen. And so.
Did you watch the recent Ken Burns Country Music?
I didn't. I'm from a time and place that makes me very wary of country music.
Hmm.
Growing up in Brooklyn in the 60s, when country music for me was associated with the segregationist South.
The Okie movement,
And the whole, Mississippi thing that was going on then with all of that hatred to me was represented by country music. I know that's unfair and inaccurate probably, but viscerally that's how I felt about country music. So even when I started to become a songwriter that was capable of writing in different genres, I shied away from that music. It never really spoke to me. I did end up writing a couple of country songs, and one of them actually did okay for me. But I'm sure that there was a lot of revisionist history in that documentary because the audience for that documentary was not the country audience of today. It was really this sort of more roots-oriented, cool cats. So I didn't.
Yeah, I haven't watched the whole series, but it was interesting to see the Johnny Cash, Bob Dylan partnership and almost kind of a respect for each other, and how Johnny Cash actually reached out to all kinds of music genre. I did not know that, how much of a overall musician and appreciation of all kinds of music he was.
And there was a lot of that, intermingling of styles going on in that period. And certainly Dylan was forefront of that. And really my favorite Dylan stuff is like John Wesley Harding and Nashville Skyline, you know. So I'm not like, I'm not against
no.
music of that kind, but it does represent to me something that was, well, like, you know, Merle Haggard sang that song about that anti-hippie song. Well, I forget what it was. you know, there was just that, that culture clash. And the end of Easy Rider always makes me feel like, you know, well, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go. He was listening to country music, that guy in the truck, right?
Mm.
So that's just my problem, though. That, that has no significance.
Well, you did, Sandy, bring your A guitar.
Yes. I'd like to do some country picking for you right now. Well, and grinning as well.
If you can go... If you want to,
yeah,
you know, you are your own artist. If if you could think back to 1968, 69, 70, and some of the influences and how you progressed and began to write your own songs, is there something that you could pull out of your catalog?
You know, I've evolved so much, Chad. I really don't think I can. No, let me think about that. Yeah, sometimes I write stuff that's a conscious attempt at recapturing that that era. I recorded a song called "Say What You Want To," which if I knew you were going to ask me, I would have practiced first. But that song, there's a bunch of them that sound that way. And I recently did a record called Wow and the band is Wow and Flutter.
Mm-hmm.
And the record is called "Love Is Getting Harder."
And that's a good, yeah, good title. Is, yeah,
you know, it's what we call double entendre in the business. And it was an attempt to recapture that early '70s AM sound of bands like Bread, Lobo, stuff that was. Not hip at the time, even. It wasn't cool. But I just thought, you know, there's so much emphasis on the 70s music, and that's kind of a forgotten genre.
Hmm.
So I did a record like that with a friend of mine who is actually my brother-in-law, who was in a band called 2020 out west, and he produced it, and we did it, and it, you know, it sounds cool. I mean, it sounds like a 70s record. We used only vintage gear from that era, and it was a cool project. So to answer your question, I would say everything I do is kind of influenced by. Is that a cop-out answer?
No.
Which would then enable me to do any of my material because it's all influenced by that.
I was almost going to say... Anything I Can Do sounds like a good title, too.
Okay, I'll do that for you. Anything I Can Do. No, songs. How much time we got?
We got time.
You got time? Okay. Because I have...
Actually...
I have a 23-minute song I'd like to perform.
No, I can't do that. Okay. How about a minute and a half song?
Oh, wow. Wow.
You're going to have to do some editing, I think.
Well, I'll play a song... That the message is relevant. How's that?
That's good.
Okay, it's called "I'm Ready for the Truth." I wanna hear the secrets and the mystery. Wanna know the meaning of you. Wanna know the future and the history. And why you smile the way that you do. I can't go with the sketch you've drawn. You left out all the grays and the blues. I'm ready for the truth. I'm ready for the truth from you.
Something deep inside you seems to scare me so. I gotta find what you try to hide. Something deep inside me says I need to know. The truth is buried deep in